All right, let's call up the next matter on today, docket number 81810, Martin v. Martin. Okay, counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, come on up.
Your Honor, we didn't file a reply brief in this matter. Am I going to be permitted rebuttal time or full 15?
Nope.
Okay, that's what I thought. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Chad Clement of Mark Yarbach on behalf of Eric Martin. May it please the court. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals' reversal of the district court's enforcement of the reimbursement and indemnification provisions in the divorce decree in order incident to divorce because the Court of Appeals properly concluded that claim and issue preclusion did not and do not apply to bar Eric's litigation and appeal of the enforcement of the indemnification provision, and also properly concluded that federal law, U.S. Supreme Court precedent, and Nevada Court of Appeals precedent preempted the district court from dividing veteran disability benefits, and that any attempt to divide veteran disability benefits via alternatives like indemnification or reimbursement are improper. There are essentially two broad issues in front of the court, and I intend to devote my time to those two issues. The leading issue in the briefing from Raina's side is issue preclusion. And the second issue is essentially the overarching issue about preemption and indemnification and reimbursement.
When was issue preclusion first raised in this case and by whom?
It's an excellent point, Your Honor. In the district court, the phrase may have been used in a brief somewhere here and there, but it wasn't cogently advanced or argued. Neither side, from my review of the briefing, advanced issue preclusion as grounds to bar the litigation. It predominantly appeared for the first time sua sponte in the district court's order. And issue preclusion really came up in the district court's order, as I read it, as an alternative to enforce the reimbursement and the indemnification provision.
Well, she relied on claim preclusion, right? Ostensibly.
So that was a point I was going to make. It's one issue with the district court's order that, unfortunately, the district court used the phrase res judicata, which, as this court noted in Five Star, has kind of been used in different ways and gets confusing in prior case law. Res judicata, as I understand it, is claim preclusion. So she referenced res judicata, but I think when you look at the core analysis in the district court's order, it's pretty clear that the court intended to apply issue preclusion.
Yeah, she's factoring it through all that.
The four factors, correct. So to kind of stay on that point with claim and issue preclusion, essentially, this argument has substantially evolved from my viewpoint in the briefing. It was sua sponte by the court, not really advanced by either side. I'm sure our side would have liked to have been able to say more about that at the district court. It was advanced at the Court of Appeals stage, and it's certainly advanced in front of you today. It is Raina's, from my perspective, it's Raina's leading argument.
So let's talk about that.
Obviously,
your client entered a settlement that included this provision that then became adopted as part of the divorce decree, no appeal, and why should he be able to go back and change it now?
Excellent question. Couple of responses. First, let me kind of clear off claim preclusion, because I think that's clearly not applicable. No subsequent litigation. Eric is not asserting a claim against Reyna in a second case subsequent action. So I think to the extent that claim preclusion was referenced in the district court order, or to the extent somebody argues it applies, it clearly doesn't fit here and doesn't apply. So I think we're on to issue preclusion and to your question, Your Honor. Issue preclusion in Nevada requires four things. The issue decided in the prior litigation must be identical to the issue presented in the current action. The initial ruling must have been on the merits and have become final. The party against whom the judgment is asserted must have been a party in the prior litigation, and the issue must have been actually and necessarily litigated. From my perspective, and our position is that the first, second, and fourth prongs are at issue in this case. Clearly, the parties are the same. On the first prong, our position is that the issues are not the same. To your question, Your Honor, essentially in the decree of divorce and the order incident to decree, there's a provision about the reimbursement, and that's it. And it's an if, and, or but at that point. At the time the court entered the decree of divorce and the order incident to it, Eric had not yet retired from the military, and he had not yet been deemed disabled from his special forces services. That came years later on. Another thing happened. The divorce decree was in 2015. I think the order incident was in 2016. Howell came out in 2017, which kind of further clarified the law with respect to indemnification post-decree.
It was certainly anticipated then, or it wouldn't be there.
I would agree that it was an anticipated potential event. Agreed. And Howell expressly acknowledges that courts should anticipate in military-related scenarios that could occur. And Howell specifically provides some alternatives or remedies that a district court could employ, such as increased alimony, prolonged alimony, other things. What Howell was quite clear about, though, was you can't use reimbursement and indemnification as a dollar-for-dollar reimbursement to get around the disability issue. So it was anticipated. Other alternatives could have been used. What was apparently employed here was a reimbursement provision. Howell came out 2 years later and essentially holds, no, can't do this. So back to your question, Your Honor, about issue preclusion. The issues are not the same. The issue that was in the divorce decree and in the order incident was not the same issue that became ripe and was subsequently litigated once Eric retired and was deemed disabled. Then the issue became, at that point, and there's a practical aspect here as well. He could have been deemed 10% disabled. He could have been deemed 50% disabled. He could have been deemed 70% disabled. There were varying facts that could have arisen and did arise subsequently that would have changed the amounts in the litigation. So the issue that got litigated under that first prong is different from the one in the divorce decree and the order incident. On that similar point, and this is essentially what the holding was of the Court of Appeals, the issue has to be actually or necessarily litigated. To your point, Your Honor, this was essentially a marital agreement that was merged into a decree of divorce, and then subsequently the order incident that was contemplated in the decree of divorce was created and entered. This issue about reimbursement and indemnification was not actually and necessarily litigated, and that was the Court of Appeals' viewpoint, was the issue wasn't ripe because the retirement and the disability status had not yet occurred.
Counsel, just because it gets a little confusing for me, if in framing, mm-hmm. the court, when we granted the petition for review, Court of Appeals, whatever they did is gone.
Correct.
So it would help me if we address this in the fact of what the district court got right and got wrong, as opposed to what the Court of Appeals may have gotten right. And in that regard, I just want to throw out on Howell. Mm-hmm. Howell there was no contemplation in the agreement about what would happen to a disability retirement or anything. And that's just markedly different than what we have here. You agree?
I don't recall that being the case in Howell. I would say that the predecessors to Howell, McCarty and others, disability seemed to be clearly contemplated. And of course, Howell does address when it is anticipated things that the district court can and should do to address that issue. To your point about what the district court, you know, versus the Court of Appeals got right, the district court's analysis on issue preclusion is difficult because on this prong of actually and necessarily litigated, there's no analysis. It just simply says that the issue was actually and necessarily litigated. I think that was error. There's no factual analysis to why the court thought that was the case. I presume it's just simply because because there was a provision in the decree of divorce and there was a provision in the order incident. But I don't think that rendered this issue actually necessarily litigated, given the subsequent events that occurred, given how coming up, and as you saw, the motion to force that subsequently enforced that subsequently came and brought this issue out. So it is our position under the four elements of issue preclusion that the elements just simply aren't met, and the district court erred in reaching this alternative basis that issue preclusion barred this appeal or Eric from litigating.
Counsel, under that theory, would a settlement agreement ever meet that prong? I mean, if the settlement agreement says, you know, we agree and it has this decision tree about how we're going to treat disability retirement or not, and you say that's not necessarily litigated, well, because it's a settlement agreement. So would it be your position that settlement agreements would never pass muster under a res judicata analysis?
I think it's an excellent question, and I think it goes to the nature of a settlement agreement versus the nature of a court order. That is something, if you read the briefing, that's somewhat at issue in this case. Raina makes much to do about the fact that this was kind of like a contract, a settlement agreement. However, the court's precedent under Day versus Day, which is cited in the Court of Appeals opinion and in our briefing as well, indicates and holds that once a contract is merged into a court order, it loses its character as essentially a private party agreement. It becomes a court order. So to follow up on your question, Your Honor, I think a settlement agreement is inherently different because I think what would probably bar somebody later on a settlement agreement is the release. And I think that is different than what we have here, where we had essentially a contingent provision in the event something did happen, and then it did happen. Then we have some intervening case law, and then we have subsequent litigation. So,
but with respect to the court's order that mm-hmm. came of that, Eric never objected to that order or appealed that order. Is that correct?
The decree of divorce and the order incident, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, did not.
So does he not have to meet some sort of a standard or some change in circumstance to come back and modify it?
Well, Eric was not the one that came back to modify. What essentially happened was the subsequent events.
Well, she went to enforce
She went to move it. To enforce it, correct. And he essentially asserted a defense and said,
right.
No, under U.S. Supreme Court case law and federal law, I mean, there's a, you know, express federal statute about it, the court is preempted from entering an order that would require me to pay disability to my former spouse. And again, you know, Hal acknowledges some of the hardship that this creates. I acknowledge that. Hal explicitly talks about some of the things that the district court could do. One thing that Raina did do in this case is she asked for one of those alternative bases that Hal indicated was available, which was alimony.
Right.
But the district court denied alimony.
But do you acknowledge, say, if we were to agree with you that it's not possible what the court did here, and this provision of the divorce decree is not enforceable because of federal law. You acknowledge, though, that the court could consider that perhaps she's got a significant change in her financial circumstances and potentially could seek alimony based on that.
I think that is an option. I think it very much is factually and procedurally dependent. It seems each case kind of arises and comes in a different way. I think ideally what Howell seems to express is that the district court should anticipate this issue when it has a military-involved individual and should, in connection with issuing a decree of divorce where disability is always a possibility, take account of that issue from the start and deal with it. But Howell does seem to indicate
that. But not
that
deal with it the way that actually happened in this case.
It could have happened that way, but it didn't.
The parties presumably did deal with it ahead of time here, right? And the court did by entering the ruling they did.
I think it was a contingent possibility, yes. And I think alimony was also a possibility that the court could have invoked at that point, realizing that that could come in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willick for Raina Martin. May it please the court. For more than 20 years, this court has held that when military members explicitly promise to make payments to their former spouses, they should be held to those agreements, irrespective of taking a disability claim. The question presented here is whether Howell changes this court's holdings. And the answer to that question is no. It didn't change this court's holdings any more than Manziel did in 1989 for three reasons. Howell did not involve an agreement for indemnification. Howell did not address res judicata. And Howell simply affirmed Manziel. And this court has already held that Manziel does not bar contractual indemnification. The two primary doctrines referenced by courts and legal experts for enforcing the kind of agreements at issue here are contractual indemnification and res judicata. Both apply here. They don't in all of the cases, but they both apply here. Contractual indemnification was the basis for the recent upholding of such agreements by the highest courts of both Michigan and Alaska, and intermediate courts throughout the country in many other states, including the community property states of Louisiana and Texas. There was no contract for indemnification at issue in Howell, in which the United States Supreme Court explicitly told courts and lawyers that they should anticipate that military retirement might be waived and do what was done here by providing for that contingency. These parties did exactly that. The decree language used in this case is identical, but word for word.
Mr. Willick, didn't your client effectively go to the court and say, court, issue an order to indemnify me
for
the loss because of the disability, which is exactly what Howell says you can't do?
No.
Why not?
What our client did was ask the court to enforce their contract for a continuing stream of payments.
And what would enforcing that look like? Indemnifying her, right? Isn't that what the enforcement would be?
If you look at the Black's Law Dictionary definition of the word indemnification,
or
yes.
Or reimbursement.
But we're not talking about court-ordered indemnification to satisfy a court order. We're talking about a court enforcing a private contract, which is what all the legal experts say is conceptually completely different. This is not a court. What was at issue in Howell was a simple, we're going to divide the retirement 50-50, because of that, 50-50, and a court deciding to impose indemnification, even though there was no underlying agreement for doing so. Those facts are completely different here. And if you look at the experts, Mr. Sullivan.
What do you do with the discussion of Manziel and Howell, where they're talking about the agreement in Manziel as being one that provided that Major Manziel would pay Mrs. Manziel 50% of military retirement?
Exactly.
Including that portion waived so that he could receive the disability payments.
Exactly. And that's exactly why Mansell came out the way it did, as this court held in Shelton. This court went over Mansell 1 and Mansell 2. Mansell 1 includes a footnote. It says, well, the state court could have looked at res judicata. That's a state issue over which we have no jurisdiction. But they didn't. They decided to make it a federal question, so we're typically going to deal with the federal question. It went back down to the Court of Appeals of California, and the Court of Appeals in California in Mansell 2, which this court talked about in Shelton, said, oh, as a matter of res judicata, he didn't have the right to go back. And Major Mansell had to continue making those payments because that was the agreement the parties made.
The U.S. Supreme Court just left that door open in a footnote, and or whatever court it originated in went through that door, and then they denied cert. There wasn't
denied cert repeatedly. They did so in Shelton. They did so in Mansell too.
But a denial of cert is not U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Now in Howell, they're characterizing this as completely preempted.
There's no difference between Howell and Mansell in the scope of preemption. They didn't address the issue of contractual indemnification, and they have said, that's the Sheldon case, I'm sorry, the names are so similar, that's the Sheldon case, that there is no substantial federal question to that issue.
Well, they didn't hold that. They denied cert.
No, that's not a denial of cert. That was a no substantial federal question. I can't give you the footnote number, but it's in the brief. And that is considered a precedential decision. So, no, there is no federal question to the issue of res judicata establishment, and they have already held that.
I think I didn't understand your answer to one of Justice Pickering's questions, and that is Mansell did involve a settlement agreement between the parties regarding the division of this money, and in that case, the Supreme Court said it was preempted and couldn't proceed.
I'm sorry, but no. What they said is the federal question. They said the state court has decided that this is a federal question, so we're going to resolve the federal issue.
Right.
But if it's a matter of state law under res judicata, that's something we have no jurisdiction about. It went back down, and that's what the state court said was exactly at issue.
So, but the answer under the federal question...
Yeah, and that's where the Michigan court in Foster just focused. There's a distinction between federal preemption as a matter of substantive law and federal jurisdiction when we're talking about, federal preemption when we're talking about an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. They are two different animals.
So how does res judicata apply here?
Res judicata applies because we have a final unappealed divorce decree. And as a matter of state law, the payment stream that was promised should be enforced. That's what the state courts are holding throughout the country. That's what all the decisions that we've cited, all of the recent, in the last 6 months, that's two or three state Supreme Courts and a dozen courts of appeal, all holding the same way.
So does that depend on the parties having entered it by agreement?
Yes.
Why would that be the distinguishing factor?
That is set out in the expert analysis by both Brett Turner and Mark Sullivan as a critical distinction. There is a world of difference between a court imposing a remedy and the parties explicitly agreeing by contract. The contractual indemnification clause, the term addressing the possibility of a future waiver, to answer counsel's question, that the benefit could be lost in the future, was explicitly raised, negotiated, and stipulated. Under any rational meaning of those words, the issue was actually litigated. The Louisiana court in Boutte made exactly that holding in enforcing an agreement just like this one. And the language at issue in this case is identical, word for word, to the language that the Alaska Supreme Court just said is fully enforceable in Jones. The words used and the terms reached are important. They are an important distinction. The Louisiana court, amicus.
If there was a litigated divorce that came to the same exact wording at the end of the litigated divorce, and there was no appeal taken from it, you're saying that res judicata would not save that?
They wouldn't. It can't be the same language because it goes by a different mechanism. What was at issue in Howell was a simple divorce decree that said, we are going to divide the property 50-50. And when he converted,
some retirement pay to disability pay, the federal definition of disposable retired pay kicked in. And what the United States Supreme Court said is a court can't go back and impose indemnification on a property division. However, they said nothing about contract. When this court decided Shelton, it looked at the contract theory. And to answer counsel's question, the contract is exactly the same. In Shelton, what you had was a joint petition. And if this court knows how a joint petition works, a joint petition is filed. The joint petition is then attached to the decree. It is merged into the decree. There is absolutely no difference between that process and a marital settlement agreement, which then leads to a decree of divorce. It's exactly the same process to get to a decree. So what this court found as a contract from a joint petition is exactly the same as the contract that the parties had on the marital settlement agreement that was merged into the decree here. There is no distinction legally or in any other way between those two processes. In Manziel II and in Shelton, the state law of res judicata.
But Manziel II is a California case.
It is.
It is not a SCOTUS case.
Right. Well, other than the denial of cert, right.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, but you look at the result. The result when there is an explicit agreement is that the payments have to continue to be made. And that is what's happened in Alaska, Michigan, Louisiana, Texas, all of these cases that we're citing.
How does that not undermine the federal law and the federal policy in a way that would warrant preemption?
Because
under
there is
the supremacy clause.
There is no undermining of the federal direction for what parties explicitly agree. That's our footnote 146. It's Brett Turner's seminal work on equitable division of property. If you take a look at the difference, it's a world of difference between enforcing an agreement between two parties and imposing a remedy. It has nothing to do with being able to raise armies or
even
serve the national interest.
Even if it calls for them to divide the disability payments that federal law say are not community property and are not to be divided.
As the Alaska court said, there is no federal interest in telling somebody that they can't make a promise to pay somebody from whatever source. No federal interest is implicated by enforcing an agreement.
There's nowhere in the agreement of the party, at least to my understanding, nowhere in the agreement of the parties in the settlement agreement, nowhere in the divorce decree, and nowhere in the court's order that led us here today, in which anybody said we're dividing disability pay, so to speak.
They didn't say that, no.
The provision. And so what would be the wisdom of not allowing a non-military spouse to provide for their for eventual recourses that hadn't yet occurred?
I'm not sure I understood what you just said, but...
Yeah, as I think about it, that was probably inarticulate. Non-military spouse divorces from military spouse who has not yet decided to waive military retirement pay.
Right.
So non-military spouse obviously wants to provide for their protection in the event that that eventuality actually occurs.
Right.
So under the argument of Eric today, it would seem like there would be no way to provide for that eventuality.
Exactly.
Just
despite
like they control 100% what's going to happen later on, and you're out of luck.
But the United States Supreme Court just said you can and told courts and lawyers to do exactly what these parties did, provide for the contingency and come up with a remedy by agreement. And they did.
Now, and counsel mentioned that there were other things that the court could have done to provide for this eventuality, but it would seem to me that if you're providing some increase to the non-military spouse for an eventuality that hasn't yet occurred, the military spouse would be objecting to, wait, I haven't chosen that and you're punishing me now.
Yeah, and that's the other way of doing it. That's what Amicus said, that you could get to the same result under Martin and Saragusa by saying that the federal interest is not implicated by enforcement of an agreement
right.
The parties make. It's a different route to the same conclusion using different precedents for the same answer. As to alimony, there was an explicit reservation of jurisdiction, and this court has had dozens of cases since the 1940s saying that such a reservation is enforceable. So the only reason, alimony was not denied. Alimony was put off because there was no notice of entry. But that was solved the same day that the court said there was no notice of entry. So at this moment, the alimony solution is available. But it's not the only solution. These parties did exactly what the United States Supreme Court said they should do, which is make an explicit agreement. And even if nothing else applied, the alimony solution would be available. And to answer counsel's other, from their briefing, they said that, well, alimony was already terminated.
I need to point out that there can be multiple forms of alimony in an order. It's very common to have rehabilitative and general or limited term plus conditional. I mean, it's very common to have multiple forms of alimony in a single order. And the termination of one doesn't implicate the termination of the others. I would like to briefly address the Byrd decision because I think this court's going to have to reach it. Byrd attempted to distinguish Shelton because of a single line in the underlying district court decision where the district court judge improvidently said that the payments had to come from the disability pay. That was harmless error because the court was right, but for the wrong reason. It was inartfully said, and that's what the Court of Appeals should have said. The casual overruling in Byrd of this court's holdings of Shelton, Duke, Crone, and Olvera from a single improvident word from a district court should be disapproved to harmonize the case law. There is nothing that happened in the recent federal cases that has changed this court's analysis for the last 20 plus years. Howell did not overturn Shelton any more than Mansell did for the reasons stated in Mansell 2, that res judicata indicates that it's a state court remedy of a state court promise and a state court enforcement of a state court contract. I see my time is up. I'd be happy to answer any further questions, however.
Colleagues, do you have any questions?
Nope. All right.